And Sam, some recent reading I've done in terms of the medical aspect, the emotional aspect of our lives, we have two brains. One brain is the brain in our cranium, but the heart also functions as a brain, not only a pump. So Sam mentioned God open our hearts, and he mentioned our eyes, and he mentioned our ears. And Harold talked about, be careful, little eyes, what you see. Now, some would say the eye is the window, perhaps, to the soul. Now, John Craypool has a book called The Preaching Event. And see, when Sam was leading our prayer, I thought of that. See, what we do in terms of the preaching event, it's horizontal. Something is happening in terms of myself as the presenter and yourself as the audience. In fact, you make the presentation come alive. It's your response. I and you have a shared responsibility. So besides the preaching event being horizontal, Sam was saying there's a vertical dimension, right? God is the one to be praised, to be honored. So we'll continue in terms of what we did last time here and maybe what we did in the Bible class, because the gospel is a never-ending story and it's all interconnected. So a novel, Gilead. In this novel by Mary Ann Robinson, it's a time of atheism. And she has a central character, Reverend John Ames, state, notice the statement, nothing true can be said about God from a posture of defense. Now, I got to think about that. See, nothing true can be said about God from a posture of defense. Either God is true or he's not true, as we saw in the Bible class this morning. And God doesn't need me somehow to defend him and somehow determine what is true. God is truth. God takes the offensive. And he did that in Jesus. A Jewish thinker says, heavy thinking will not lead you to faith. See, we need, David, thank you. We need more than just thinking. Heavy thinking by itself will not lead you to faith. We need something else. And I just think of titles of books I have, Leighton Ford, part of the Billy Graham Association with Billy Graham at the time, a Canadian, by the way. He writes a book called The Christian Persuader. See, what's our mission? A Christian Persuader. How do we persuade? And another book he has called Good News. It's for sharing, making friends for God. Well, a secular article by Andrew Phillips in The Star this week. He talks about politics, the lost art of persuasion. See, in politics, you're either on my team, my side, part of my base, or you're not. If you're on the other side, I condemn you. You're evil. You're unworthy. I choose to demonize the other side. And so here's the polarization in politics and in life. But Andrew Phillips says three things that might relate to Christian persuasion, Christian approaches to teaching the gospel. He says it's best to start from a position of genuinely trying to understand the other person's belief system, like where they come from, what they believe, and why they believe what they believe. And then he says we need to listen to people's concerns, even though they or we may disagree with them in terms of their perspective. And then he says, try to persuade people and not simply dismiss them. Well, Buffy St. Marie, a Canadian icon, an activist for peace, Indigenous, a folk singer, a writer, She, too, has her truth, and her songs indicate her truth. Of course, she was famous by being a mother and being on Sesame Street for years, and that's how a lot of people know her. But she says about the end of her life, the good she's trying to do, changes sometimes take a long time, and then all of a sudden, they happen. Think of people. So that's why I never give up hope. I just keep on paddling my little canoe in the right direction. So think of Harold paddling his canoe in the right direction, making a lot of noise, making it fun, and hoping other people will follow. See, that could be a object lesson, if you would, in terms of Christian persuasion evangelism. The proclamation of the Word of God is not pulpit proclamation per se. See, if we have the gift of proclamation, it's not a ministry given to just a few people who might stand before you on a given Sunday and speak. With Martin Luther, during the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, the pulpit was elevated in the churches, and the sermon became the focal point of the worship service. Proclamation is essentially person-to-person communication. And what we do, we add our testimony as a further witness to the Jesus story. And that's all I can do. I add my story, my little bit of insight, to your insight in terms of who Jesus is. But it's our active goodwill, our compassion before the watching world that reinforces our verbal presentation. See, without our lifestyle, our goodwill, our compassion, perhaps the verbal message is not heard. When we share our words about Jesus as the Word of God, then our story provides healing and liberation. See, I have a right. I have a right to speak to other strugglers because I too am a sinner. In the words of George Buttrick, I'm a beggar who's been fed, telling other beggars where the bread is. So do you know anyone that's had a problem with eyesight recently? Dan. Is that Dan back there? Yeah. Do you know anyone that's had an eye problem recently? And you've mentioned that in the service before. You mentioned Tim Zavitz.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So I saw Tim two Sundays ago. He was in short service, where I was. Then I saw him driving a car. I said, your eyes are better. Yes, yes. See, he had to lay down, I think you told us, for a month. Yeah, on the stomach, right? So Mary had laser surgery, okay, in and out in December. Now she can see the crossword puzzles. Mike Goslin, a good friend, he said many eye surgeries, but they canceled the surgery this past week. So he has to have another surgery, and the problem is always he's blind. He's blind, legally blind. We go for walks, and I'm blind too, and I lead him. So an article says each gene tells a story. Three brothers in the Ottawa area, they're born with a disease whereby the vision becomes progressively less and less. When they do the research in Montreal, they find a gene controls other genes. They have to test 200 genes for this particular disease in the eye. And when they find the one gene that's a mutation, then there can be healing, there can be improved vision. So in John 9, we read the first 11 verses, but it's the whole chapter. In John 9, Jesus heals a man born blind. He's blind from birth. And see, the question becomes a question of belief. So in verse 1, and if you have a Bible, you might follow along, and I'll sort of indicate maybe as we skip through, okay, various verses where we are. And so I know downstairs, I went downstairs, and here's the passage, John 9, not just the first 11 verses, but the whole chapter. So in verse 1, here's the case, the medical case. Jesus is on the road to Jerusalem, and he encounters a blind man. And this man becomes a theological case in terms of debate. In verse 2, the disciples asked Jesus, why was this man born blind? Whose fault is it that he's born blind? Who sinned? Did this man sin before he's born? Before he was born? Or is the fault of the blindness his parents? Somebody must have sinned. See, that's what their assumption is as the inquiry of Jesus. See, in the Old Testament, it says, sin has generational consequences. It usually mentions the fathers. The sins of the fathers are visited upon the children onto the third and fourth generation. See, that's 100 years. And John Bradshaw, he says 95% of people are dysfunctional. And then he says the other 5% lie. Well, if that's even remotely accurate, and the scripture, of course, is accurate, then there's generational consequences in terms of our sin. Now, the Jews, they borrow from the Greeks the notion of prenatal sin. See, some people today believe in original sin, prenatal sin, spirits perhaps, entering the womb, a reincarnated soul, either good or bad, enters into a preborn life. See, that's what some people thought. Now, in verse 8, 9, and 13, the disciples engage in abstract speculation. Do they really see the man who's born blind? Do they demonstrate any compassion? Is there any empathy? See, the neighbors, the man's neighbors, they characterize the man, he's a beggar, perhaps a nuisance. He's unproductive. For the most part, the neighbors are indifferent. He lives in their community. But when the Pharisees challenge them to identify the man after he's healed of his blindness, they were challenged, unable to really identify him. Well, he looks like the man. He might be the man, but we're not really quite sure. After the blind man is healed, the neighbors present the case for adjudication to the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees, they want to use the blind man and the disease of blindness as a political weapon against Jesus. See, this man was healed by Jesus on the Sabbath day. Ha! Now we got a case. Jesus did this. Jesus is a sinner. Jesus is guilty of breaking the Sabbath law. Now, not the law per se, but the Talmud, which is a Jewish interpretation of Jewish tradition. Now, the blind man, when he's asked to recount what happened, his answer did not conform to the preconceived design of the Pharisees. And so they excommunicate him from the temple. He's kicked out, if you would, of the assembly, the church of that day. But notice verse 3. Jesus makes a response. Jesus says, no one sinned. Sin is not the cause of his illness, his blindness. However, can you think of disease? In this case, it's blindness. It may be lameness. It may be cancer. You name the disease. Jesus says the blindness in this case is an opportunity for the glory and grace of God to be demonstrated in and through this man's life. Now, to Jesus, the man's condition calls for action, for compassion, for act of good and God will, not theological discussion, not speculation, not debate. See, Jesus is the way. He's the highway, God's highway, to compassion. And if I'm a disciple of Jesus, compassion runs right through, Sam, as you said it, our hearts, okay, if we are Jesus' disciples indeed. So notice the cure. The motive for Jesus healing the blind man is compassion, in spite of the Sabbath, in spite of the fact that Jesus knows in advance there will be a religio-political protest against the healing. See, the primary motivation is care, compassion for the person, which is a higher value than conformity to some inhumane application of a quasi-legal standard. Note a similar passage in Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 35. See, Luke records another man who's blind, who is healed by Jesus. This man recognizes Jesus and says, Jesus, have compassion, have mercy on me. So in Luke 18, 35 beginning, as Jesus approached Jericho, see, the first one we're talking about is Jerusalem. This is Jericho. A blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked, what's happening? And they told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. He called out, perhaps a loud voice, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And those who lead the man or lead the way rebuke him and say, be quiet. But he shouted all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. What does Jesus do? He stops. He orders that the blind man be brought to him. And he says to the blind man, what do you want me to do for you? Well, what would you say if you're blind? Lord, I want to see. And Jesus says, receive your sight. Your faith has healed you. Immediately, he received his sight. And he followed Jesus, praising, worshiping God. And when the people saw it, they praised God. They worshiped God also. Look at verses 6 and 7. How does Jesus cure? Well, have you ever burned your finger? Have you ever hurt yourself? What do you almost instantaneously do without thinking? You might. Okay. Put your finger, the burn, the hurt, in your mouth. Is that medicinal? It's probably a normative kind of reaction. Remember the rich man in hell, in Hades? He calls out to Father Abraham. He calls out to Lazarus. Have him, Lazarus, dip his finger in water and come to where I am in torment. Place his finger, the tip of his finger, with a drip of water on my tongue because I'm in tormented. I'm being tormented. I'm in agony. See, what Jesus does in verses 6 and 7, he uses saliva. Now, we may not think that's sanitary these days. Jesus spits. Singapore, you're arrested. You're fined. He spits on the ground. He makes mud with the saliva. He places a mud pack on the blind man's eyes. Now, in the ancient world, people thought spittle, especially that of an important person, might have medicinal or curative properties. Think of how we experience the world. See, Harold talked about our senses in the song. Sam talked about our senses in the prayer. See, we might experience the world via our eyesight. But if we lack eyesight, we have to, let's say, depend upon the other senses. In this case, the sense of touch becomes the pathway, a critical pathway, for the blind man to understand the world. See, Jesus uses touch to heal. Many who sought healing, they just wanted to touch the hem of Jesus' his clothing. And Jesus said in Matthew 9, Matthew 14, on various occasions, your faith has made you whole. Now, in this case, Jesus' touch, the weight of the clay on the blind man's eyes, Jesus' words, go and wash in the pool of Siloam in Jerusalem. The blind man received Jesus' words and Jesus' touch. He acted upon what Jesus said, and he received the gift of sight. Now, if you receive the gift of sight, you might tell somebody, right? So here's a confession. The blind man comes to faith in Jesus as the Son of God in progressive steps. See, it doesn't happen Buffy St. Marie overnight. Sometimes you come to change to faith, to truth, in a gradual fashion. He was asked in verses 10 and 15, on more than one occasion, how were your eyes opened? Remember, he's blind. How were your eyes opened? How did you receive your sight? Notice verse 11. He provides his testimony. Do I have to defend Jesus? Do I just tell my story like it is? His testimony is simple, direct, factual, personal. The man they called Jesus made some mud, put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam, wash. So I went and washed. And the result, I can see. Now, he tells this story, first of all, to his neighbors, who are motivated by curiosity. And then he tells his story at least three times to the Pharisees, who are motivated by controversy and conflict. The Pharisees, verse 16, are divided. They proceed to debate. What is the source of Jesus' power? Like, who is Jesus? Is Jesus a sinner? If Jesus is a sinner, he can't perform miracles. Can Jesus heal? Can Jesus perform miracles? Then his power must be of God. See, they find themselves in a rock and a hard place if they want to attack Jesus. In verse 17, the blind man is now asked to testify again about Jesus. And he states in verse 17, Jesus is a prophet. Look at verses 18 to 23. They didn't like his answer. So they called in the parents. They intimidate the parents. Is this your son? Was he born blind? How then can he see? See, the Jewish leaders had pre-decided that anybody who acknowledged or confessed Jesus would be excommunicated from the synagogue. So the parents, they defer. Ask him. He's of age. The Inquisition continues. But notice in verse 24 the warning of the blind man. Give God the glory. Well, that seems right, doesn't it? But what they really mean is, give God the glory, blind man, confess. We don't believe you. Tell the truth. We already have concluded and know that this man Jesus is a sinner. Give us your assent. Come along with us in our cause for fellowship. Verse 25 beginning, the blind man responds, "Whether Jesus is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." That's his confession. That's his testimony. See, I'll just tell the truth. This is my story. Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I've already told you, and you do not listen. Why? Do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" Isn't that interesting? So they hurl insults at him. "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. But for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." Notice the blind man, his wisdom. Now, that's remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So the Pharisees, unbelief. No rational, no theological answer to the blind man's personal testimony. So if you can't answer rationally, what do? Notice verse 34, they attack him. "You were steeped in sin at birth." We can dismiss you. "How dare you lecture us?" And they threw him out. A church father, John Chrysostom, says, "The Jews cast him out of the temple, but the Lord of the temple found him." So in verse 35, notice verse 35, Jesus heard that they'd thrown him out. And when he found him, Jesus said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" See, that's a term for the Messiah, the Christ. "Who is he, sir? Tell me that I may believe in him." And Jesus said, "Eyesight, insight, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking to you." And the man born blind said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. See, my whole point is, I guess, I don't have to defend. I simply tell my story in terms of Jesus, what he has done to and for me. The blind man made a connection. That's how you learn. You have to make a connection. The blind man connected the voice of the one who healed him with the Son of God, the Messiah, the Son of God. He now sees with physical eyes and spiritual insight. God is no longer an abstraction, but a personal presence to be worshipped. Verse 39, Jesus says, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see. I once was blind, but now I see." Maybe that's John Milton. Amazing grace, right? "I once was blind, but now I finally see." Jesus says, "For judgment I've come to the world so that the blind will see, and those who think they see, a lot of them, will turn out to be blind." Verse 39. Just prior to healing the man born blind, Jesus said, As long as it's day, in verse 4, "We must do the work who sent me. Night is coming. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. That's said before the healing takes place. Now, John also testifies in John chapter 1, in Jesus was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not perhaps understood it or overcome it. The light shines in the darkness so that through him all men might believe. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world, John 1, verses 4 through 9. You might know the name Leonard Cohen, the late singer, songwriter, a song called Anthem. Now, he has a Jewish background, and maybe he's thinking as a Jew when he writes the words of this song. A few lines. Think of the Jews. Think of modern Jews. Cohen sings and writes, "We asked for signs. The signs were sent. The birth betrayed." Was that a sign? The birth betrayed, the incarnation. "Signs for all to see." Forget, Jews, Cohen is singing. "Your perfect offering." See, our sacrificial system, our religious systems. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So in this story, the blind man, in faith, acts upon the word of Jesus. He accepts the word, who is Jesus? That's how the light gets in. He is now gifted with both eyesight and spiritual enlightenment. The crack, our openness to the truth, our eyes being opened, we let God's light in. So here's the process. How do other faith strugglers like ourselves and like this man come to faith? So the process is, the man born blind recognizes a man called Jesus. And then he recognizes Jesus as a prophet. And then he recognizes Jesus as one sent from God. And then Jesus as the Son of Man, the promised Messiah, the Christ. And then he recognizes Jesus is the Son of God, God in flesh and blood appearing, and we have seen him and experienced his grace. Hence, the blind man believes. He worships. He becomes Jesus' disciple. So, is that Christian faith? See, you, me, we are led to a personal encounter with Jesus. We reflect upon our own personal story and vision. Like the Emmaus disciples in Luke 24, we had hoped, but our perspective was all wrong. There were other believers. They share with us the story, the vision of Jesus that they have. They fill in some of the gaps, like in the Emmaus story. And now we come to a moment of decision. We act out our faith. A little faith, a lot of faith. We make a choice to be or to become Jesus' disciples. See, proclamation, we're all about proclamation. As Jesus' disciples, we all have the gift of proclamation, maybe not from a pulpit. We naturally tell, share our story. We add our testimony to the Jesus story. I add my testimony on top of your testimony. And all of us have a testimony, and all that together makes an overwhelming difference to the world. Now, as I share my testimony, tell my story, you do the same, other faith strugglers might begin to see and know and Ian perhaps live life reflective of the light, revelation, glory of God in Jesus Christ appearing in Luke 2, verse 32. Jesus has the very last word. Jesus says, blessed are your eyes because they see. God sees us. God sees the sparrow. God sees us. And in return, we see God. And like the blind man, I was blind, but now I see. Blame Jesus. He did it. I'll follow him as his disciple. He is indeed the Son of God. The hymn, appropriate. It asks the question, doesn't it? I always got to think about this hymn. We're singing, it is well with my soul. I might ask the question, is it well with my soul? And how do I ensure that it is well with my soul? So it's always a response to Jesus in terms of our invitation hymn. You may lead us. Let's stand as we sing.